I would like to share, as the brothers mentioned, a subject that is quite close to my heart, is something that I've been involved in the study of many, many years. And originally it started as a short talk for when our young people went to Canada for 10 days. And so I was asked to give this message, and it was supposed to be short, maybe 20 minutes. And then when I started writing out my notes, my printer did not malfunction that day. And it turned out to be a little bit more than a few pages. So, and I was not really planning to give this anywhere else other than that trip, but I've gotten several requests already. And I see this as a big issue for our day. And I will right away claim that and tell you that I do not know everything about this subject. Someone once said that to learn all there is to know about music, it would take 200 years. And I don't have that long, and I don't think any of us have that long. So to start, I will give you my conclusion first. And the conclusion is this, that a tree is known by its fruit. There's no way around that. A tree is known by its fruit. I have yet to see someone make wrong musical choices and progress spiritually. I have never met such a person. If you know of somebody, I really would like to meet them. For me, this seems to be a rule with no exceptions. If you make wrong musical choices, you cannot progress spiritually. And to start, I would like to sort of engage your minds and what I would like to share. And one way that I can do that is by asking questions. And I don't necessarily need an answer. It's just more of questions that you can think about to yourself. But if somebody has an answer, I'd feel free to call out. And the first question is deceptively simple. And the question is this: what is music? What is music? You know, when we think about it, it seems, that's easy. But when we try to put that into words, I mean, just think about to yourself right now, how would you describe music? You know, we know what music is, but to put into words, it's a little difficult. And, it's difficult for me even to exactly put it into words if I wouldn't have given it much thought. And so I would like to share a few definitions that I found and to lay a foundation for the message. And the interesting thing I found was that the word itself, the word music, comes from a Greek word which means to muse, which means to think. I find that very interesting. And we know that muse is opposite of amuse, which, as far as I understand it, means not to think really about what you're doing. Some other more dictionary type definitions I found would be the following. An art of sound in time that expresses ideas and emotions in significant forms through the elements of rhythm, melody, harmony, and color. Another one would be the science or art of ordering tones or sounds in succession, in combination, and in temporal relationships to produce a composition having unity and continuity. And that is quite a mouthful. I don't expect you to have it all memorized. I don't have that memorized myself. But it sort of pushes us into giving more of a definition for what music is, at least to the best of what people have been able to come up with. And some more questions that I would have is, do we consider as Christians that music has its own morality? In both definitions, the word art was expressed. Even if we think about the word muse, you know, is it possible to just have some sort of a thoughts that in time do not lead either into morality or immorality? You know, so do we consider music as having its own morality? As this art of having morality, have moral value to it? If moral, what standards or principles do we measure it by? You know, we can very quickly pick out if a picture that we see in a book or a magazine is moral or immoral. We can quickly do that. But what about when we hear something, hear music? Can we discern and determine the moral content of it? What is immoral music? If we agree that music has its own morality, what is immoral music? Or not moral music? A question I get asked very often is, how do you discern the moral music from the immoral? Now, these are all questions that I'd like to try to give some clarity to by God's grace. And I would really appreciate if you hear me out. And like again, I say, I do not claim to know everything. I'm always going through the process of refining my understanding on this subject because it is very, very broad. And I'm always going through a process of refinement, trying to see what does God have to say? What are God's thoughts on this? And I'd like to say this, that music communicates on a subconscious level. It is a lot like wind. You can hear it, you can see the results of wind, but has anybody ever seen wind itself? And you know, one of the areas that I still don't understand is why music has the effect it does. I don't understand it. You know, that's just something I'm still thinking about, and I have a hunch that I will be thinking about it for quite a while, for years to come, is why music has such an effect that it does. And I'd like to start off by talking about music in the Bible. The Bible is the foundation for the life of the Christian. And music is surprisingly mentioned very many times in the Bible. It is present everywhere throughout the Bible. It is used to praise, to warn, to summon, to prophesy. And it is mentioned hundreds of times. And by some estimates, music is mentioned around 500 times in the Bible in its various forms. So it is a subject that the Bible has much to say on, has many examples to give us. We know from the book of Genesis, God, as the creator, was the one who set up music. And it degenerated with the fall of Satan, just as everything else did. You know, Satan is not a creator. Satan can only take what is already created, and he never makes things better. He only makes things worse. Exodus tells us how God restored music to its original purpose when he called the nation Israel out of Egypt. And there are verses that we could read on where God put in his standards, his law, on how music should be used to praise him and how it should be done. It later degenerated. We read all through the book of Judges what kind of low state the people of God fell into. And then, from what we read in 1 Chronicles 16, we see how God once again rescued music with David. And then it degenerated again. So we see this rise and fall of morality on this subject. And I want to get in a little deeper in that by reading some scripture here. We read about music at the time of creation. And this is not in Genesis, it is actually in Job, chapter 38, verses 4 through 7. If somebody wants to, they can turn there. But it says the following, "Where was thou when I laid the foundation of the earth?" Now remember, this is God talking with Job. "Declare if thou hast understanding, who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest, or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. In heaven, we read of a lamb as it had been slain. And when he had taken the book, the four beasts and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having every one of them harps and golden vials full of odors, which are the prayers of saints. And they sung a new song, saying, Thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof. For Thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by the blood out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation, and hast made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. Speaking of heaven, it's been said, and the question has been asked, is there anything that is man-made in heaven? You know, think about it. It almost seems bizarre to ask such a question, if there's anything man-made in heaven. And some people will say, well, nail scars on Jesus' hands are man-made in heaven. Well, when preparing for this message, I looked in the Bible to see if there was actually a place where we could point to and say that, yes, there are still nail scars on Jesus' hands in heaven. We know when he was resurrected, he still had them. But when he ascended into heaven, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I couldn't find a Bible verse about that. But there is something in heaven that is man-made. You know, it is a very, very interesting verse in Revelation 15, verse 13. We read the following, And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, Great and marvelous are thy works, Lord God Almighty, just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. And you know, that fact that they sing the song of Moses, I mean, it just baffles me. How can something that was composed here on earth make it into heaven? I think this verse, it tells us a lot about the value God puts on music. You know, nothing else that I could find, that is man-made or man-composed or created by man in heaven. You know, but we read of them singing the song of Moses. Speaking of heaven, some ministries will not be needed there. Preaching will not be needed in heaven. Preachers will be out of a job. Visiting the sick is also not needed in heaven. Helping the poor is not needed in heaven. Comforting the troubled is also not needed in heaven. You know, so very many things that we do here on earth will not be needed in heaven. We cannot love our enemies in heaven. There won't be any. We have to learn how to do that here. There are many things that we do in this life that prepare us for heaven. And I believe that musical preparation also starts here, because we will be doing that for eternity. We have an eternity of music to look forward to. We also in the Bible read of the misuse of music. Exodus 32. And it is a chapter that begs for deeper study than what I can give here, because it talks a lot about the way human nature works. And so I will not be reading the whole chapter, but I will recall a few scenes that we know from that chapter. And remember, the main scene is that Moses is in the mount and Joshua is close by. Aaron makes the golden calf. And then we read that the people, they eat and drink and rose up to play. And then we read, And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said unto Moses, There is a noise of war in the camp. And he said, It is not the voice of them that shout for mastery, neither is it the voice of them that cry for being overcome, but the noise of them that sing do I hear. Music played a large part of their so-called worship, which was heard before it was seen. And one of the reasons I think Moses had the discernment to understand what was going on, because where did he spend his first 40 years of his life? He spent it in Egypt, being educated there. And that was the center of culture and commerce and everything put together at that time. It was the world power, as far as I can tell, at that time. And he knew what was going on, even before he saw it. Do we remember the sight that Moses and Joshua met when they came down to the people? It says that the people were naked. And that fact makes me ask the question, what kind of music, which we know was present there, is present when people are in that state? Is it holy, holy, holy? Eternal Father? Some of the other songs that we would have sung today? You know, I can't imagine the kind of songs that we sang today fitting in that kind of a picture. You know, the movie industry has its foundations on in having the right picture and the right sound to it. I don't know if anybody's ever seen videos or clips or anything that were professionally done. You will notice that what you see visually is complemented audibly. Very much so. And if you see that, and if you see a moving picture, a motion picture, where the music does not complement the video part of it, then you will right away see that something is wrong here. You know, if you see a funeral, you will see mostly, you know, sad music. You will not hear some galloping music or some marches, you know, because it doesn't make the pictures. They do not come together. It gives two different messages. Music, apart from the words, if there is instrumental or vocal, or if there are no words, music will always give a message of its own. It'd be good if we remember that, because it will help us discern. Sometimes we can listen to something and the words will just be very good, but you will have this feeling in your heart, something's not right here. Something's not right here. And especially if we are sensitive to the Spirit of God, God will lead us to the correct understanding of this subject. Let's talk a little bit about worldly music. What principles make music worldly? Or what musical principles can make music worldly? There's different ways of looking at it, but it's essentially the same thing. There is no verse in the Bible that says, "Thou shalt not listen to," and then names a group, or an artist, or a song. There's no such verse. If there was, it'd be a lot simpler, but there's no such verse. So, we must measure the morality of music through other principles that we see clearly laid out in Scripture. And one main principle that I take as my foundation in discerning is found in James 3 verses 13 through 17. And I'm sure that these verses are familiar to most of us. And here they are. "Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works with meekness of wisdom. But if ye have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy." And see, we have again that principle of good fruits. Of a tree is known by its fruit. And we read here of two kinds of wisdom. And I believe that depending on the kind of wisdom used, we can determine the morality of the music. If the music is based on worldly wisdom that is from below, it will have the characteristics of earthly, sensual, and devilish. If we have music that is created by heavenly principles, by the heavenly wisdom, wisdom that is from above, it will have another set of characteristics, like we read. And the key term I would like to underline here is the term sensual. And when I was doing a study of what this word actually means, the Greek word is psukikos. And the definition of that is the sensuous nature with its subjection to appetite and passion. The sensuous nature with its subjection to appetite and passion. It makes me think a lot of the lifestyle of animals. You know, what is the whole point of existence of animals? Is it not to eat, sleep, and reproduce? Or to have fun, you know, just live. So that, because animals, they are created by God to have a subjection to those things. That is their life cycle. You know, they do not have a soul. People created in the image of God, we have a soul. We are called to a far higher purpose than just to eat and sleep and do what feels good. You know, if I could put a motto to the modern world today, it would be this. If it feels good, do it. That seems to be the direction where humanity is going right now. And I would like to add a little clarification. When I will be using the term sensual, I told you the definition that I imply when I will be using the term sensual, but I want to clarify what I will not be implying. And that is this, that there are things that are pleasing to the senses, that are perfectly right and wholesome. That's not what I'm talking about. For example, eating a good meal or a walk in the park. Those things are not wrong in themselves. The difference, the Christian takes an objective approach to those things, whereas we cannot take an objective approach to sin. Sin will always subject us to its power. We cannot be sinning and have control over sin. It will always have control over us. So I would like for us to keep that in mind as I use that term and try to give examples how I think it applies in our present day circumstances. The other time the word sensual is used is in Jude verses 18 and 19. And it says the following, how that they told you there should be mockers in the last time, who should walk after their own ungodly lusts. These be they who separate themselves, sensual, having not the Spirit. So this verse tells me that you cannot be sensual and have the Spirit of God at the same time. Those are two very opposing spirits. And it's either one or the other. You cannot have both. And it is interesting to note that the only category of people that support the argument that music is amoral, which means without morality, has no moral value, is the contemporary Christian music culture. Again, it is very interesting to note that there is something that conservative Christians and punk rockers have in common. And that is that both of those groups, both of those extremes, believe that music is has morality, has moral value to it. You know, very, very interesting, because I can't think of a group of people that we'd have more of opposing views than with a crowd like that. And so that tells me something. Why? Why would conservative Christians that have conservative values and punk rockers have some things in common? Could it be honesty? I would like to give a definition of what when I will be using the term contemporary Christian music, or CCM for short, I would like to give a definition of what the world considers that. Okay, this is taken straight off of Wikipedia. Anybody can go online and see this for themselves. It says the following. Contemporary Christian music, or CCM, is a genre of modern popular music which is lyrically focused on matters concerned with the Christian faith. Today, the term is typically used to refer to pop, which stands for popular, rock, or praise and worship styles. So that is what the world today sees contemporary Christian music as. And the president of the Gospel Music Association once said, there really is no such thing as a Christian B-flat. Music itself is an amoral vehicle. The problem I find with that is that B-flat in itself is not music. It is only a building block of music. If we take any note by itself, it is not music. It is only a building block of music. That would be like the alphabet. You know, we use the same alphabet to create words that will bless, and we use the same alphabet to create words that will curse. It is depending on who is creating the words. The same alphabet. I believe it's the same thing with music. Depending on who is creating the music will determine a lot of what its moral value will be. And there are two problems that I find with CCM. And these are principles that pretty much cover most of this musical style. That if we are sensitive to, and if we ask God for discernment, He will lead us into an understanding so we can make wise musical choices. The first one is the rock beat. Okay, and to explain what I mean by this, I have to give you a little bit of background. And the rock beat, it's from rock and roll. Something that came, that is from there, what is a very characteristic part of that style. And just like out of curiosity, who knows what the term rock and roll is slang for? Could I see a raise of hands? Okay, I only see a handful of hands. Okay, which I would like to give you a biblical definition of what that term rock and roll means. Okay, it means fornication. So to say that Christian rock and roll is to me a very big oxymoron. You cannot have that. Those words cannot be together. It is like saying dry water. You know, you can't have dry water. So Christian rock and roll is something that you cannot just reconcile in your mind. So that alone would warrant the whole style being thrown out of the Christian's life. But let's just talk about what makes rock and roll rock, or what makes it sensual, what makes it sinful. I have to give you a little bit of a background to music, or like a little introduction. Music is made up of three elements. Going from our definitions, it's made up of three elements. They are the melody, harmony, and the rhythm. Each of these three elements affect a different part of you. Melody is the main part of a piece of music, and it can stand alone. That's how we remember the tune of the song. It is like the main focus of a picture. You can have the melody all by itself, and it will make sense to whoever's listening. Okay? Harmony is when you play or sing two or more notes at one time, and it carries the melody. It determines the kind of feel the music has to it. It is like the background to a picture. The harmony will determine whether the music is minor or major, whether it's happy sounding or sad sounding, whether it's serious or whether it's has more of a light, playful atmosphere to it. That has a lot to do with the harmony. And rhythm is what your body responds to. One author stated, and I thought this was very very true and revolutionary in a way, is that one author stated everything from the cycle of our brain waves to the pumping of our heart all work in rhythms. We're a mass of cycles piled one on top of another, so we're clearly organized both to generate and respond to rhythmic phenomena. Now, that again is a mouthful, but when we think about it, that is what we are. To the beating of our heart, we have a heart rhythm. We have, just the way the author states is about the cycle of our brain waves, and that's the subject. I'm not too familiar with it, but I have heard that that it is fact that your brain does send out brain waves, and it's almost like studying up a little bit on technology. It's amazing what people are messing with when they start researching this area. And rhythm is what I want to look at specifically. If you remove the emphasis on rhythm from modern music culture, Christian or secular, the whole thing will come crashing down. And that is why that is the predominant, you could say, attribute of music that is out there in the world today. Rhythm should only be a spice. It should only be the skeleton on which the musical body hangs. Like, for example, you see me, I'm standing up here, and each of us, we have a skeleton. But we cannot see each other's skeletons. It's hidden away. But that is what gives us form. And rhythm, you cannot have music without rhythm, because if you do that, it will just be unorganized sounds or unorganized music at best. So if the difference between music and sound is that the music will have all three of those attributes. So rhythm by itself, there's nothing wrong with it. It is absolutely needed. Today, all of our songs had rhythm to it. It's what kept the music flowing in an orderly fashion. So it's not a bad term. Maybe you've heard it used as in a bad way, like, or with some negative attributes to it, but that by itself is not a bad thing. Rhythm by itself is not a bad thing. It is how you use the rhythm that is what can give it the different feelings that it produces in people. And I would like to give an example of how you can tamper with a good song just by tweaking the rhythm a little bit. Okay, and I'll do this example several times. I hope that everybody gets it. And the song that I would like to use for an example is the song Rescue the Perishing. I assume that pretty much everyone here is familiar with the song, so that's why I'll be using it. The rhythm in Rescue the Perishing goes something like this. Rescue the perishing, care for the dying. Okay, I'll do it once more. Rescue the perishing, care for the dying. Now watch. If I take that beat, that rhythm, and I misplace it just a little bit, it will sound like this. Rescue the perishing, care for the dying. I'll do it once more. Rescue the perishing, care for the dying. Now, could I see a raise of hands of who got the difference between the two? Okay, very good. Most of the people here. So I... If anybody after the service has any questions where I could give a different example, I just want to be quick here, not to take too much time. I'd be glad to explain in different ways. But did we all feel how the spirit or the feel of the song just changed completely? It changed from being almost in a march-like fashion to having dance-like qualities. And that is what dance music is all about. It is about those rhythms that will misplace the natural beat of a song. And they will make your body want to respond. They will give you such a feeling of wanting to move your body. And that is why we see what we see at all these concerts, whether Christian or secular. We see people moving, we see different ways they use their bodies, at these concerts is why. It is largely due to the fact of the beat. And so we have to be careful. Any time that we listen to something with repetitive rhythm all the time, again, rhythm should be just a spice. It should not be the dominating factor of the music we listen to. Because then you're putting the things that your body responds to at the top and the things that your soul and spirit respond to at the bottom. And that is not the right way for a Christian to live. Again, good song, good words, but how the spirit changes when you change just one element. Okay, now I would ask if I have several sound clips that I would like to play, because the next part that I would like to talk about, it is something that I wouldn't want to give an example of my own for, but I would like for some example clips to be played. They are very mild compared to what is out there, but they represent the principle of what I want to talk about very clearly, just in these. So if we could have them play right now, while we listen, let's think about them and just analyze it and try to analyze what we hear.
The day I looked into your eyes, another Monday comes, and I just want to breathe. 'Cause it's a long, long week for someone wired to please.
Okay, thank you. Now, did we understand what was going on, and we could sort of put descriptive words to what we heard? That what we heard is what's called a pop voice, a popular voice, okay, a popular style of singing. And let's just for a moment analyze the voices we heard on those clips. Now, I'll be quick to say that there was not a big accent on music there, on the instrumental part of music. What I want to look at is the vocal part of what we heard. And the first question I will ask is, do we talk that way? Does anybody here in normal conversation, do they talk that way? Why not?
Well, of course you don't talk that way. It's very inappropriate, and I'd even say it's scandalous to talk that way.
So how would you even, you know, what kind of descriptive words would you give to that kind of a voice? You know, some of the ones I think that would fit would be crooning, sultry, you know, intimate, and I'd even go as far as to say as erotic. And the closest thing you can get to when like this, if a person did talk that way, it would be intimate whispering. You know, we can just hear that quality being projected in both of those clips. And just a question I'd like for us to ask ourselves: what would you think if someone talked to you in that kind of a voice? What about if somebody talked to your husband or your wife that way? You know, what would you think? And I ask myself the question, you know, and I think about this, like, stuff like this is being played all the time and being absorbed by young people in conservative Christian circles. And what is the message behind that? You know, the kind of voice that we have, the message that our voice gives, and the words that we use, they can be completely different messages. And I think we need to be on guard for that, to make sure that the kind of voice that we use, either when singing or speaking, that it would complement the words that we are saying. And again, all our words have to be wholesome and godly. And I would just like to sort of talk about the mechanics of that, of that what I would consider sensual sounding voice. How do people learn to sing in that kind of a voice? I've never heard little children who grew up in a conservative environment sing that way. Yet sometimes when these children get older, they start sounding the way we heard on those audio clips. And I ask myself the question, why? That style, it doesn't really require much learning. All it requires is for you to hear it, like it, and, like, again, it's not taught, but it's caught. If I hear a young person, or any person, singing that way, then I could tell almost what kind of music they're listening to. Because what comes in will come out. And if you don't have a position on music, and you don't actively defend it, that style will become your default position. And I'd like to speak a little bit about the mechanics of why in times past you did not have people singing that way, whereas right now it's all over the place. In days past, if you wanted to be heard, you had to learn to project your voice. And I'd like to give you an example of what a projected voice is, if we cannot turn the microphone down. It's, O Lord my God, when I in awesome wonder consider all the worlds thy hands have made. And that kind of voice is a voice that will be heard by everybody in the room. And I don't have that powerful of a voice, but there are people that can project their voice to where they can fill a room 10 times this size with their sound. That is a projected voice. The kind of voices we heard, you cannot project without sounding like a donkey, as I say. You can't do it. And what made what started the avalanche of people starting to use this type of voice in their singing is the invention of the microphone. Again, in days past, if you wanted to be heard, you had to learn how to project your voice. Right now, you can talk or sing however you want, and you will still be heard. A projected voice is what a preacher uses when he wants to be heard. Isaiah 58:1 talks about that. Cry aloud, spare not, lift up thy voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression and the house of Jacob their sins. Is there anything more important besides showing the way to salvation than to bring people to a realization of their sin? You know, it is interesting to know that to project your voice, the shape of your lips must resemble a trumpet to a degree. And some might think, concerning the example that I sang, is, you know, isn't that an operatic voice? You know, and I just want to assure you that if I sang opera, then you would be able to tell. It would sound completely different. So all I showed was that of a way that we can project our voice. And I find that, I just want to add this little side note here, that I find that an adamant opposition to any kind of vocal instruction usually ends up at the other extreme, which is sensual music. So just some things for us to think about. And I would like to reach my real conclusion at this point. And I would just like to say this, that CCM, if you have any part in it, it is a slippery slope. It is a slippery slope. And there's an article written by a young woman in 2011 who was a teenager when CCM was really beginning to take on. The article is inelegantly yet fittingly titled Sniffing Glue. And a little bit about her background. She was homeschooled until 10th grade, went to CCM concerts, listened to all the albums that were coming out at that time, and was later exposed to MTV. Now, who knows what MTV is? Again, a handful. That's good. That's good that not many people know what MTV is, but to make this example worthwhile, I'm going to have to tell you a little bit about what it is. It is music television. It is music videos made up by the world's artists and groups, and it is predominantly filth, audibly and visually. And I would not recommend anybody dabbling with that, because you will be defiled. And this was her response when she was exposed to that. And again, this is years after years of listening to CCM. This was her response. She says, "I couldn't have told you what the word irony meant, but I knew I'd been cheated by Christian rock. This was crack, and I've been wasting my time sniffing glue." In other words, this was the real stuff. This was the stuff that the Christian artists were imitating, but because of the fact that they had to use Christian words, they were somewhat limited in that. Her parents disapproved of secular rock music, so she continued to listen in secret. Finally, she says the following, "Despite all the effect of teenage rebellion, I continued to call myself a Christian into my early 20s. When I finally stopped, it wasn't because being an unbeliever made me uncool or outdated or freakish. It was because being a Christian no longer meant anything. It was a label to slap on my Facebook page next to my music preferences. The gospel became just another product someone was trying to sell me. And the paltry one at that, because the church isn't Viacom, which is a global mass media company. It doesn't have a department of brand strategy and planning. Staying relevant in late consumer capitalism requires highly sophisticated resources and the willingness to tailor your values to whatever your audience wants. In trying to compete in this market, the church has forfeited the one advantage it had in the game to attract disillusioned youth, and that was authenticity. By being involved in this kind of a way to influence people, the church loses its authenticity. It loses its separation. She goes on, "When it comes to intransigent values, the profit-driven world has zilch to offer. If Christian leaders weren't so ashamed of those unvarnished values, they might have something more attractive than anything on today's bleak moral market. In the meantime, they've lost one more kid to the competition." You know, and that sort of honesty is horrifying to me. She says it plain, "I used to call myself a Christian. I no longer do." And she credits CCM for pushing her in that direction. When you want to combine Christianity and the devil's music, Christianity will lose any type of authenticity it has. Because you cannot serve two masters. You cannot have two different spirits at one time. You cannot be sensual and have the Spirit of God. This article was posted online, and there was the ability to add comments to it. And so I browsed through the comments a little bit, and there was one comment that was particularly striking. And the writer says this, "I really enjoyed this article. Weirdly like reading my own memoirs. Funny thing, the Christian Acts imitation of secular artists motivated me to give them a listen and discover they were actually better. So those early naysayers were a correct warning of the slippery slope of so-called Christian rock. And I'm just happy and grateful I went down that slope." Now again, this is a horrifying kind of honesty. Of a person saying, "They did, I was warned, and I went down, and I'm happy that I did." It reminds me of a verse in Romans 1, verse 32. "Who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them." And so I'd like to present to you a solution as I see it. A solution to this dilemma. We have to make choices. Every day, every time we listen to any piece of music, we have to make choices. And the first principle that I see that how a Christian can make the right choice is plain and simple, don't be naive. Do not be naive. 2 Chronicles 2:11 says, "Lest Satan should get an advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices." I've heard of some parents setting the following standard for their children. "As long as it doesn't have instruments." But as I remember from the clips, there was not a big, you could have gotten rid of the instrumental part of it and the effect would be exactly the same. So do not fool yourself into believing that as long as it doesn't have instruments, it's going to be okay. You know, many people have bought in for that lie. But look at the fruit. Look at the fruit that it produces. We need to study and observe the real thing, which is godly music, unmistakably God-honoring music. And the example I like to use is that bank tellers study the real money to be able to spot the fakes. You know, they study those bills until their eyes pop, if I could use that term. And we must surround ourselves with God-honoring music, you know, if we want to be able to discern. One thing you can do is the following. Because wrong music desensitizes you, it makes you oblivious to the fact of what is right and what is wrong. One thing you can do is you can try a musical fast for a month. Listen to unmistakably godly music only for 1 month, and then you will see, listen to unmistakably godly music only for 1 month, and then you'll see what will happen to your musical tastes. You will see the changes that is produced in your spirit when you start listening that has sensual qualities to it. And I would like to say this, that it is very hard to draw a clear line in music, but it has to be drawn. It has to be drawn somewhere. I purposely don't mention the names of groups or artists. To me, the moral content is the deciding factor of what is acceptable and what is not. And my personal position is that I put the devil's music on the same level as pornography. I do that because the end result is similar. The question is, how much do we tolerate that? We sometimes make a big deal about not dressing immodestly, but often we will allow a sensual, vulgar manner of singing without thinking too much of it. We must always ask ourselves the questions, is this music causing me to muse, or is it amusing me? There's a difference. To muse means to think. To amuse means to be void of thinking. Psalm 47 verse 7 says, "For God is the King of all the earth. Sing ye praises with understanding." We must know what we're doing. Listed in 1 Chronicles 16, 8 through 12 are 9 reasons David gives for the music he's writing, and they match what Psalm 68, 4 and Colossians 3, 16, where it talks about psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, say about the 3 categories of music. And I will read that portion of Scripture. And we will conclude with that. 1 Chronicles 16, verse 7 through 12. "Then on that day David delivered first this psalm to thank the Lord into the hand of Asaph and his brethren. Give thanks unto the Lord. Call upon his name. Make known his deeds among the people. Sing unto him. Sing psalms unto him. Talk ye of all his wondrous works. Glory ye in his holy name. Let the heart of them rejoice that seek the Lord. Seek the Lord and his strength. Seek his face continually. Remember his marvelous works that he hath done, his wonders and the judgments of his mouth." Now, there's a good standard for music making. And those are principles that should be reflected in our music. This is a directional issue. It is part of a package. The way you view music, it is part of a package. It is impossible to accept CCM and keep other defilements that come along with it at bay. It is impossible. I have never seen it done yet. And we must make a choice. Will we be part of God's restorative work, building His kingdom, or go along with the flow of this world into the degeneration that we see all around us? Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this message. We trust that it has been a blessing to you. If you would like additional sermons or a catalog, please visit our website at effortofministries.org. Call us toll-free at 855-557-7902 or write to us at Effort of Ministries, 400 West Main Street, Suite 1, Effort of Pennsylvania, 17522. You are welcome to copy this message for free distribution. This ministry is supported by your donations. May the Lord Jesus bless you.